1-3-3-1-1-3. Initiating broadcast of Fascinating Nouns in 3, 2, 1.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Fascinating Nouns. Now, if you are listening to this transmission, we are still the galaxy's most trusted source for incredible people, places, things, and ideas. Now, together we arrive at this curious nexus point, and we will explore the strange, unusual, offbeat, bizarre, intriguing, interesting, invigorating, quirky, quaint, quizzical, weird, wild, wacky, the fun, the frivolous, and the fringe, plus all the spaces in between. I am your host, Daniel J. Glenn.
Hello, Fascination. Welcome to the show. Well, you know that history is littered with all sorts of mysteries and strange phenomenon and even hidden places, lost cultures and ancient civilizations, many yet to be uncovered. Today, we're going to cover possibly one of those civilizations, and that is the lost continent of Lemuria. And if you don't know what this is, it's basically the concept of this gigantic continent in the middle of the Pacific Ocean that was there originally to help explain how lemurs ended up in Madagascar. It turned out it ended up with a gigantic UFO-based cult centered in Mount Shasta, believing that the Earth is hollow. Quite a journey. I think we can all admit that that is quite an evolution. And hopefully, we're going to explain that evolution today. I've got Justin McHenry on the show, and we're going to walk through how Lemuria started out as a continent and ended up as a concept. And we got to get into this because there's a lot to talk about. So, Justin, thank you so much for being on the show today. So the first thing I've got to ask you, you have a pretty dangerous job, and I'm always very impressed by people who put their life on the line on a daily basis. So you're an archivist, I believe?
Yes, is that, I am.
Yeah. Are you? So what's that like? I mean, do you put your family in danger every single time that they're, you know, the head of the household might get destroyed in the underground bunker or anything like that?
Yes, well, it is actually... especially when my previous archivist job, when I was working with a lot of 18th century documents, I feel like I've breathed in enough like 18th century dust and like just paper spores and stuff like that to be like a at least like half colonial. Like it is like hazardous in that sense, like you're just breathing in weird stuff if you don't take in like the precautions of like proper masking and just mostly masking, just breathing in a lot of weird stuff. Cause as you're brushing off all the dust and stuff, it's like, I should probably put a mask on right now. If I had
to. Well, it's crazy because, you know, I mean, this is getting, you know, a little ridiculous what I'm about to say, which is just a precursor for what we're going to talk about today. But, you know, you hear stories, you know, because of the global temperatures are rising, all of a sudden permafrost is melting and these viruses and bacteria that haven't seen the light of day for millions of years are suddenly coming to the surface and we're not, you know, fit to fight them off. So the next global pandemic could come out of the Arctic, or it could come out of an 18th century book that hasn't been opened in 200 years or whatever. So
definitely.
You know, it's dangerous.
Dangerous. And you're open those pages up, you don't know what's been in there for forever. No. Too. It could be like a magic mushroom or something like that.
Sure.
Pop out, so it could and blow you in the face.
Sneezed in there 200 years ago. I mean, it gets dangerous, but but I'm glad you're doing this work. And so we're going to talk about the what's known as the lost continent of Lemuria. Is there any proper way to say it? I mean, I want to get this right.
I don't think so. I do not believe there is a proper way since it's not a real place. So I don't think there is a actual real pronunciation for it.
Well, so now that is and isn't true. Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, it may not be a real place, but it was a real concept that people came up with. You know, I mean, I think that that's kind of so someone who invented it originally, invented that word, did have a way to say it. But I, before we get into that, I want to learn how I love these types of topics. Right. Like I love things that really they're a little odd, a little different. And this definitely fits checks all those boxes. Right. Yep. But how did you kind of stumble across this, get involved, get interested? Because it's not some, you know, archivists are you guys are into history, real history, you know, documenting things that really happened, looking at real artifacts. And this is more a story that evolved incredibly. I mean, you know, the original part is bacteria and the end story is man, basically. Yeah. I mean, that's how different the two are. So how, like, what appealed to you? How did you get into this? Did you stumble across it? Did you fall into it? Did you open up an 18th century box and there's all the manuscript?
Yeah. So I've always been fascinated by, I guess, just strange stuff, UFOs mm-hmm. and all of that and that sort of things. And so just being in that world, mm-hmm. I've run across Lemuria in different settings and different mentions of it throughout periods. So mostly it's been through Madame Blavatsky and her use of Lemuria, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. but also knew about the Shaver mysteries and how Lemuria played in with his stories. And so when I was, my day job is an archivist at a university. And so I was writing an article on scientific primary sources. And I knew about Lemuria's beginnings as a scientific concept. And so I was like, well, I thought that would be an interesting thing just to show off students, just to show students how to use, like, you know, historical scientific primary sources. And then I mm-hmm. started getting into it and it kind of just blossomed from there. And not having seen anything really written recently about the whole history of Lemuria and the idea mm-hmm. of Lemuria and all the people who kind of believed in Lemuria throughout the centuries and how they brought it forward in each iteration too.
So that that is interesting because it hasn't really worked like that. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, I was, you know, so I have another project that I did a bunch of interviews a while ago, looking to do a documentary, and I've been recently turning it into a podcast audio documentary. And I stumbled across, that was the first place I heard of Lemuria. I actually have dealt with the Lemurian Fellowship here in Ramona, California. I'm here in California. And so learning about this as a concept, this is more in the spiritual sense. So in the evolution of the continent, this is towards the end. You know, this is more towards modern times than it was in the scientific version you're talking about. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, I stumbled across it. I'd never heard of it. You know, to people listening, since you're just learning about it, it's similar to the thought of Atlantis, this advanced civilization that existed on a continent that no longer exists and was washed beneath the waves. They're very similar, mm-hmm. just if you want an idea of a starting point to where it kind of is now. Yeah. But it started out as a real scientific theory. And I'm going to leave that cliffhanger there for 1 second, because there's one other piece of business that we got to get to. And this one I thought was really interesting. This might be the nugget of the podcast, Justin, and it has nothing to do with Lemuria. And that is that the opening sentence, "It was a dark and stormy night." I've always attributed that to Snoopy. And it turns out that was occultivist Edwin Bulwer Lytton who originated that. How did you come across that? And are we sure that it was not Snoopy?
Yeah, well, Snoopy is Snoopy is a known plagiarizer, so I don't. sorry, Ken Davis.
Oh man,
who wrote Snoopy? Charles Schulz.
Charles coming in hot early. All right.
So he was a fascinating character in and of himself, Bulwer Lytton. So he pops in at different segments throughout the Lemurian story, and he was very influential. And like just 19th century esoteric thought and beliefs too. But he was also a writer, like a very much popular British, like pre-science fiction type writer. Mm. And so he was the first one that popularized or came up with the "It was a dark and stormy night" as a first sentence.
Wow. I really thought that was interesting. And you mentioned, you know, the idea that he was, a short story writer, you know, science fiction, fantasy. That's kind of a theme, not only with this particular story, but with a lot of stories when it comes to religions, New Age, where people, you know, are failed sci-fi writers who suddenly become, you know, New Age thought leaders, you know, basically all they did is turn the switch from "this is fiction" to "this is fact." Yeah. And now all of a sudden it's a religion, which is kind of amazing. But so let's start in fact. Why don't we start in science here, Justin? And so Lemuria started out as a scientific theory and very quickly it goes off the rails. You know, it kind of becomes an improv sketch or a Chinese food order gone wrong, right? It's just a lot of and then, yes and, which I love. And this is going to get very confusing very quickly. Mm-hmm. And since my audience isn't really, I'm guessing they listen for all sorts of different reasons.
Yeah.
But let's pretend that no one knows what we're talking about. Let's go slowly here, Justin. So let's start in science. Mm-hmm. What is the origin of just the concept of this?
Okay, so the origin of Lemuria, it comes from a very specific place and a very specific person. The originator of Lemuria was a British ornithologist, a man who studied birds back in the 1800s. His name was Philip Lutley Schlater. And he was giving a talk to the Linnaean Society in London. And he was just going over the mammals of Madagascar, just running through them piece by piece. And he gets to the most famous mammal on Madagascar, the lemur there. And he starts, you know, he just describes lemurs and all of that. But then he starts getting into, well, how did lemurs get onto Madagascar, which was a major scientific mystery, and is still a mystery today. About, like, no one really knows for sure how lemurs got onto Madagascar, just because
I want to stop there for a second. So let's explain what a lemur is. For those watching at home on YouTube, you can see behind you, you do have a stuffed lemur. Well, it's a plush lemur. It's not a lemur that's been stuffed via taxidermy. Mm-hmm. But so you can kind of see what it looks like. But what is it? I mean, it's a primate. They've got ring tails. Most people know that. But what is it exactly? What is the animal that caused this phenomenon?
It is just a primate, just like a monkey-like species. There's many different varieties of lemur. So the most well-known is probably the ringtail lemur, but there's, 20 or 30 different types of lemurs, and then there's, different differentiations within that. But they are all only found on Madagascar. Mm. And so as Schlater was describing all of this, he gets into there's lemur-like species in South America. There's lemur-like species in Africa. There's lemurs on Madagascar, and there's lemur-like species in Asia. So how did all that, happen? So there must have been a land bridge connecting all of these different places at one point in time. And at the very, very end of his talk, he goes, let's just call that place Lemuria. And it just stuck.
Well, and this is not unreasonable, right? I mean, you mentioned, lemur is a very interesting animal. As you mentioned, it's only found on Madagascar. Mm-hmm. And to this day, we don't exactly know how they got there. That is weird, right? Yeah. Like, that is a weird thing we haven't solved. And it is not unusual for people to take different things that land bridges were kind of being discovered. I think it was in the mid 1800s that the Arctic Pass was the USS Terror. That's a famous story where people trying to get through the I think it's the Arctic Pass or
the Northwest Passage.
Yeah, right. Yeah, so, but they're seeing all of these connections, and and this is before you start to see people realizing that the continents shifted and that they fit together, right? So this makes sense that there are these hidden pieces of land where animals and people are crossing over literally. So this is not that far-fetched, and it's at the time, a pretty solid theory. We can at least say that, right?
Yeah, definitely. And it was very within the scientific realm at that time, too. And also, you would have other scientists just basically agreeing with Schlater and taking up this idea of Lemuria and using it in their own scientific theories and topics, especially when it comes to animal migration, which was a big thing at the time. And also, you mentioned the continental shift. And so, just how continents came to be and came to be formed and moved all around. So Lemuria was very much at the center of all of those debates going on in the late 19th century and early 20th centuries.
It's also interesting how the ocean, before humans traversed it in large numbers or, and discovered the new world and made all these big discoveries of other continents, the ocean was kind of this mysterious place. And it was believed that, you could swallow up whole cities and, and islands and all this. And it doesn't quite work that way. It just kind of is what it is. Like the it's water levels that really reveal, you know, things, right? Like you can't just have an ocean, something gets swallowed up unless the bedrock is destroyed. Like it doesn't make sense, right? Mm-hmm. But at the time, it was this big mysterious place. And, you know, I'm not going to go into detail here, but in your book, you do a great job talking about lemurs and how cool they are. As a matter of fact, they're so territorial that they do handstands and write their genitals on trees, wipe genitals on their trees to mark their territory. So they're pretty cool. You know, I like that. I wish I could do that. I've done it in the past, plan to do it in the future. But so we're not going to get into all that right now. But Madagascar is a really cool place, too. You talk about it in the book, roughly the island bigger than California. It seems that there's still a level of mystery here. And the Landbridge had a competing theory, one that I find, you know, equally as interesting and significantly more adorable, and that is that the lemurs rafted 250 miles from Africa to Madagascar, which is not outside the realm of possibility, although a little strange. I think one of the things is that maybe they were hibernating, fell out of a tree, fell onto some logs, and floated 250 miles to Madagascar. Not outside the realm of possibility. But I don't know which one is more improbable.
I just love that the amount of scientific just back and forth and like just vitriol going between the two sides. You have the rafting side and then you have Landbridge slash exposed islands, basically, in the Mozambique Channel, where they kind of just hopped, skipped, and jumped from Africa to Madagascar. And so you have a lot, and they're just like, they're running tests, they're running like simulations based on storm passages, on like, you know, once in a lifetime storms, like how long would it take for a raft to travel across the Mozambique Channel from Africa to Madagascar. And so it's just a weird, and it's also like, so it's not just lemurs that need to raft onto Madagascar. It's everything on Madagascar needed to get over there, even like the bugs and everything else. And so it's like, are those rafting over there as well? So it's really, really interesting. And if you're a science nerd sort of way.
Right. Well, you need like a Noah's Ark, right? You need like an African lemur Noah to come build a small little ark with just the species that exist on Madagascar, right?
Yeah.
But what I love about this is it's a low probability event, right? Like the rafting thing. Yeah. And you're right. Like I think George Simpson put forth the rafting. I believe he was an early descendant of the Simpson line that created Homer Simpson. Very possible here. But when you think about the concept that, you know, a million monkeys in a room at typewriters, given infinity, will create Shakespeare, right? Mm-hmm. You could say that a million lemurs sitting in Africa eventually will create a raft and go to Madagascar. It's not outside the realm of possibility. You know, primates are pretty smart, you know, even lemurs, right? So, but I love this. So, but this is the beginning of the weird theories, though.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's also strange just because man didn't step foot onto Madagascar until, you know, only like 1500 years ago, 1800 years ago, which is like thinking about, like, you know, man has been around for 10,000 plus years. Like, and there's a bunch of humans on Africa. You would think that, you know, they would be the ones rafting over the Mozambique Channel into Madagascar. But it wasn't like the first people onto Madagascar were from, you know, Southern Asia and like the Java area or Indonesian area, and they're coming across the thousands plus miles of like the Indian Ocean and stuff like that to get onto Madagascar. So it's just there's mysteries abound all around Madagascar, from the people to the lemurs to everything else.
Yeah, it is really weird, because I think you mentioned that, and it's 250 miles from Africa.
Yeah.
You know, the humans, from what we can tell, originated in Africa. You know, Homo sapiens evolved there and we spread out across the world. I this really made me think, too, like, were there not enough people in the southern eastern side of where's Madagascar? It's the eastern side, right?
Yeah.
The eastern side of Africa, that they just didn't boat that way. Could you not see? I mean, let's say you couldn't see the island. You're not just going to raft out in the middle of the ocean, right? That doesn't make sense either, right? So, it's like strange common sense, but it's really weird that because it's so close. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it's like it's so close, but yet so far away. It's kind of like, I mean, you wouldn't expect people in England to raft to Ireland, you know?
Yeah.
But I don't know. It was just it's really bizarre when you think about it. So
yeah.
So let's talk about it. So then you know, this is going on in the 1800s. And let's talk about the 1860s. So Ernest Haeckel, is that how you say it? Is it Haeckel?
Yeah.
Haeckel.
Haeckel.
Ernest Haeckel, who's a German Darwinist. Now, this is kind of an interesting guy. Let's talk about him, because you call him the greatest invertebrate zoologist of all time. These are big things here. Let's give him his bona fides.
Yeah. So, yeah, he studied radiolarians. So there's these little, like, crustacean-like things in the Mediterranean. And so, like, he dedicated his early part of his life to doing that. And he was an early advocate of Darwin. And so his work on radiolarians really helped establish some of the scientific proof that Darwin's theories needed. So he was part of that, like, first generation of Darwinist scientists going around studying species and finding that scientific connection between, you know, natural selection and you know, just evolution. Mm-hmm. So he was really doing that. And he did a lot of work, like in the field work, testing out theories and just seeing the evolution in the radiolarian like fossil species or fossil record that was around there in the Mediterranean.
Well, not only that, so he was doing that. He also, you know, due to his enthusiasm for Darwin, you mentioned that most people learned about Darwin from basically his proselytizing of him.
Yeah.
You know, he spoke the gospel of Darwin, you know, according to Charles. And you say he's the primary source of the world's knowledge on Darwin. So was it Origin of Species?
Yeah, so the Origin of Species was Darwin's book. And that set forth his ideas on natural selection and just the general ideas for evolution.
Yeah.
In between, so Darwin wrote really two major works on evolution: the Origin of Species, which was the first one, which didn't talk about the evolution of man. But then he wrote a second book about, you know, 15, 20 years later, called The Descent of Man, which talks about you know, human evolution.
Right.
In that time period, Haeckel would release his book, The History of Creation, which does get into the evolution of man, but it also just brings in all of the Darwin's ideas, but also the scientific. It was almost like I don't want to call it a textbook, but it was a general laying out of all of the scientific work that was going on at the time, kind of like providing the scientific proof for Darwin's ideas. And it would go through many, many, many iterations after it was first published. I think it was first published in 1876, and then in German, and then a few years later, it came out in an English translation. And so when it came out in its English translation, it went through 20 or 30 different editions. He would update it every couple of years, providing like the new information that's coming out on evolution. So he would include new studies that were being put forth and everything else. And so it was really a way, it was like almost like a book size newsletter for people to like to stay up to date on evolutionary theory and thought at the time.
Jeez. What, a 3,000 page newsletter?
A very dry scientific newsletter, but like it was like, you know, people just had they had more attention span back then too.
Right.
Didn't deal with that.
Yeah. No one says give it to me in a 30-second video on an app. So he was an amazing artist as well, and he drew, you know, lots of the natural world, coined lots of scientific terms. You mentioned ecology and phrenology. He was the first person to literally say World War One.
Yeah.
In response to World War One, and his book, he included a map of Lemuria in the History of Creation in the 1920 edition. And I believe my German's pretty poor, but the original title of the book is Naturalik Schöpfungsgeschichte.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yeah, that is correct. Yes.
That's not bad. That's not bad. So why did he? So now, why would this evolutionary scientist include a map of Lemuria in his book?
OK, so since we were talking about he was a Darwinist, he believed in evolution, mm-hmm. and he was writing about the evolution of man. And so he primarily needed a place for man to evolve from a primitive ape to a to our human selves. He needed a paradise for this like kind of evolution to take place. And for him, Lemuria provided the perfect world for that. And even his Lemuria, he moved it out directly into the Indian Ocean. And so you already see a shift in the Lemuria where it gets kind of cut off from everything that Schlatter put forth. Yep. And then he set it off directly right smack dab in the middle of the Indian Ocean. And so, and you know, that is a kind of like a paradise. There it's, you know, perfect weather, perfect everything, perfect conditions for man to evolve. And then once they have evolved, for them as a launch pad for them to spread out all over, you know, India and Europe and Africa, all over the place. And so for him, Lemuria provided that perfect Goldilocks zone area.
Well, what I love about this is its theories are evolving, right? Like, it's still science. Like, they're still saying, hey, the continents don't move. So if the continents don't move, how are we getting people all over the world? We know, I don't know if they knew it that mankind started in Africa. It sounds like they did because they're using that as basically the origin story. So if we got people starting in Africa, that's where the Homo sapiens evolving. How do we get them across the world with so much water in the way? And he does a great thing. He moves it to the center of the ocean. So it's like an aircraft carrier, basically. It's like, where's the central location where you could go to and then go everywhere else from that location? So it actually makes a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. And I think there's, you know, you include maps where you have just arrows going like, oh, okay, well, this is where people went to India. This is where people went to Australia. This is where people went to, you know, the Americas. So it does. It fits a theory that... I don't know. I think it holds up. I think it's a really good theory for the time.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And he was theming, you were mentioning that, and it's like that's just thinking scientifically about it as well. It's you're seeing where everything has been found so far, and every like even looking at he was looking at, you know, animal migrations as well, and incorporating that into his theories. And so he was finding those connections, and from those connections he based his theory of man evolving on Lemuria and placing it right there in the Indian Ocean.
Easy to get to, easy to go from, you know, like an airport hub. So this is also the point, you know, where everything's kind of still getting kind of a little strange even as we go along, right? So Haeckel ties race to Lemuria. And races throughout the history of human evolution has always played a role, you know? And I'm not going to sit here with 2024 eyes and condemn people like our society likes to do now. This is in context. So at the time, this was a common thing to do. But this is where a lot of that begins, which then becomes a whole sub-genre later on, right?
Oh, yeah.
But it kind of begins here, you know, and I think it comes from a desire to put Europeans at the top of the human food chain. Mm-hmm. And this is kind of where, like, who's, and this is every race, every culture has their own way of putting themselves on top. But if you're on top, you have to be on top of something, and that's other people, so that other people become, by your logic, inferior. And however that's ranked, it really just depends on where you're from. You know, so this is not unusual throughout history. But for as far as this story, this is where it begins, I believe.
Oh, yeah. And, like, it's so surprising to see a German, white German man all of a sudden placing white Germans at the top of his racial hierarchy. And so, but you see that throughout, you know, the evolution of Lemuria, but also just the evolution of science and people thinking about science and race as well.
Yes, yes. Things go kind of sideways in Germany. So yeah. Later on. Well, and you even mentioned just very briefly, here's a side note, that Darwin's cousin, Francis Galton, kind of laid the building blocks for eugenics. So that immigrant soiled Croesus bloodline, which caused their downfall. So it's always a subplot. It's always a subplot. So that's going on. So that we're in science still. We're still in science, Justin.
Yes.
You know, now you cut into... you cut into the book, you start talking about Atlantis.
Yes.
I'm hesitant to go into Atlantis too deeply because in the story of Lemuria, it gets very confusing.
Yes, it does.
But basically, there's also hierarchy here of which came first in the theory. Atlantis, I want to just talk about very briefly where the thought of Atlantis comes from, because I believe it comes from Plato. It wasn't created out of whole cloth. In modern times, we take it from an ancient Greek philosopher, but it may have been created out of whole cloth in his time.
Yes, definitely. Okay, yeah, and so I bring up Atlantis in the book just because it, after Haeckel, and you get the Theosophist and everybody else taking over, you get really Atlantis and Lemuria married together. So it's good to just have a general understanding of what Atlantis was, where it came from, and like. Basically bring it up to where Lemuria gets created too, because we're at Atlantis high point, I would say, like with the people believing in Atlantis and studying it, and it's, you know, pop culture and all that sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm. But peak Atlantis is what you're saying.
Yeah. But in the 1860s, when Lemuria first started coming out, like, you know, Atlantis ideas were at a nadir. But so it goes all the way back to Plato. He writes about it in two of his dialogues, Critias and Timaeus. And he gives the story. He actually puts it in the mouth of Solon created or was told about it from, you know, these Egyptian mystics. And that was even like 800 years before he was talking about, like, he was, you know, having Socrates talk about in his dialogues. And so, and then, you know, afterwards you have Aristotle bringing it up. You have some other Greek philosophers talking about it and kind of making fun of the idea too, which was pretty funny. Mm-hmm. But then it like dies off and it stays died off until the Renaissance, when you have Italian monks translating Plato's dialogues into modern, you know, Latin, and it really kicked off another era of Atlantis lore. And then you have to start having people actually look into Atlantis and trying to find it or thinking it's a real place. Because a lot of times up until the 16th century, it was very much a theory or an idea or
an ideal.
Yeah, exactly. An ideal location, or, you know, just a representation of an ideal republic or an ideal land.
Yeah.
But then you have someone like Olaf Rudbeck going in and studying it really hard. And he was a famed scientist of his day. Mm-hmm. And his theory was Norway, I believe, or maybe it was Sweden, was really Atlantis, and the Norwegian people were Atlanteans. And so he even wrote this huge book that has never been translated into English, sadly, talking all about that. And, you know, it got Newton intrigued into it, and Newton wrote to him and was like, hey, can you send me a copy? And then it kind of died off again until the 1880s, when you have a failed Minnesota politician, a guy by the name of Ignatius Donnelly, like, started studying Atlantis and wanting to, you know, try to solve that mystery. And he kind of did, I guess, in his own way. But he brought it forth, and he popularized Atlantis once again. It's never really has gone away since his time as well, too.
Well, you call him the greatest failure to ever live. So lots of superlatives in this book, which I love. He was an American politician and hustler. And yeah, he started looking around for Atlantis. You mentioned a couple people interested in Atlantis. Sir Francis Bacon is always interesting to me. I've done a couple episodes of the show on him and whether or not he was the original author of the Shakespearean works, and I believe Olaf believed that he was, or a lot of people in this story also believe these types of things.
Donnelly was a great Shakespearean author, you know, theorist as well too.
Questioner, theorist, yes, yeah, that's a polite term for it. Mm-hmm. Right, so Donnelly, yeah, he believed that Sir Francis Bacon may have written them as well. Now, this is what I love about him is that, you know, there's a lot of similarities with people that are popular now, you know, both in this world and in other worlds, where you kind of, if you're able to dress up BS enough and make it sound like it's science, people believe it. You know, I mean, he would quote when he was discussing Atlantis, you know, he wrote a book and gave it the veneer of science. You know, you mentioned he quoted Nature, Scientific mm-hmm. American. He uses biology, volcanology, geology, you know, land bridge arguments. You know, he uses all the scientific buzzwords of the time to make you think he's done research, but it's not at all research. And this is fascinating because this template exists to this day. You know, I've interviewed a lot of people who do this. I know several people who are authors or publishers of these types of books. And it's just so fascinating to me how you can make it work. And it's kind of believable.
Yeah. Yeah. He was like almost an OG hustler, like in that sense.
Yeah.
Like he was getting into it. But he believed it too. And so there's something to that. But he was very much just using any and everything possible. And so instead of letting the evidence and the research drive his ideas, he had an idea and he was finding evidence and research to just back up that idea.
Right.
And so that's primarily what he was doing. And he was also using quasi, like, looking at, you know, history from one area and history of the other and making those connections as well, like diffusionist type arguments. And it really set the tone for, you know, like you said, a lot of the researchers that have become popular, you know, from Eric von Daniken to on up to like Graham Hancock today. It's still around and still prevalent.
Yeah, you know, researchers, a generous word for some of those people. You know, Eric von Daniken's been on the show. You know, and I find the theories interesting, right? Like some of this stuff, these are interesting concepts, but to claim truth or research on things that are not knowable, that's where I think we run into problems, right? Like there's nothing wrong with a good theory, you know.
No, I love them. Yeah, they're amazing.
I used to love weird theories. I love weird conspiracy theories before they were dangerous and threatened our democracy. But I was, you know, I'm old school weird conspiracy. And I always think of them I'm an open-minded skeptic. I think of them, I consider them. But a lot, there's just not enough research to ever really go full into it. Now, this changes that mindset for people reading because it seems like it's research, but it's not. And this is the moment, I think, where science starts to shift into pseudoscience for Lemuria in particular, where you're mixing Atlantis, which is not fully researched and substantiated. Lemuria is still a concept, you know. And I think he kind of splits Atlantis as the originator of culture. Lemuria is the originator of civilization. So you start defining these things, but it's still science, but it's more pseudoscience at this moment. And then I think the real turn, you know, and I think you've mentioned this is not some concept I'm coming up with, but is theosophy. Helena Blavatsky, Madame Blavatsky, who shows up in a lot of my episodes and a lot of stuff that I work on. You call her the most influential person of the 19th century. Now, I think I kind of agree with you because her fingerprints are all over everything. As a matter of fact, I just interviewed Russell Targ, who's a famed researcher at the Stanford Research Institute. Did remote viewing for the government, you know, studies paranormal phenomenon, you know, highly accredited. He was a theosophist.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Okay. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I
didn't know that either. But it's so my point is, it's everywhere. These concepts, there's something to them. They resonate with people in an interesting way. And she started all of this.
Yeah.
So I just find it intriguing. And what I'm getting to is that, as far as Lemuria goes, as far as the story you and I are telling right now, this is kind of where it goes from place and science to concept and spirituality.
Yes.
Philosophy, yes. Right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, definitely. Okay. Yeah, so where Haeckel was doing his physical evolution on Lemuria, Blavatsky mm-hmm. was doing spiritual evolution on Lemuria. It was Lemuria was a part of right. her spiritual evolutionary idea.
Yeah. And so there's a lot to her, right? And yes, so I want to do some touchstones so that we can get to other stuff. But what I think is interesting is that she basically, in your book, she wandered the earth for 25 years, from mm-hmm. 18 to 43, accumulated knowledge, you know, and there was this real belief that, you know, actually this other project I'm working on, this same theory was at least still a concept in the 60s, was that you go to Tibet, you go to the Andes, and you wait for a master to come and teach you.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what happened with her, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So she was, according to her, if she is to be believed, she would be one of the only Westerners allowed into Tibet, I guess, pre-20th century, just because Tibet was closed off to the West, and it was also a very dangerous place to, like, the Himalayan foothills apparently were running rampant with bandits as well. So it was just, like, physically dangerous, but also there was politically dangerous as well. So it was an almost impossible place to get into, but she managed to do it twice, I believe. In her, her travels too.
Yeah.
So, or I think the first time she did it, and then the second time she did. So, close once, did it the second time.
So she's an amazing woman, nonetheless.
Yes, she truly is.
A lot of ways. But I think, you know, she brings a couple of things to the story. You know, she brings a concept of ascended masters.
Yeah.
And I believe she does channeling as well. She brings that to this story. And idea of root races located in Lemuria as a way of human beings evolving.
Yes.
Right. And that's kind of the place where it happens. So let's just I want to tie in and summarize how she takes Lemuria as a scientific concept and uses it for her own purposes. And what's the sausage that comes out of that machine?
So she was wholly interested in the spiritual evolution of humanity. And so as part of that, she created these things called root races. And so there's seven root races through different periods, epochs in time. So the first one were, you know, we were just gassy. We were basically just ideas of humanity or spiritual ideas. Fully spiritual, enlightened beings almost. And then we kind of evolved into a gaseous cloud. And then the third root race is what happened, took place on Lemuria. And that's when that gaseous cloud actually formulated into a physical being. And it began evolving on Lemuria, the physical and spiritual combined into basically humanoid shaped beings, and then they slowly evolved into humans. So at the end of the third root race, the Lemurian age, humans were around, but we were just really tall. And then the fourth root race happened on Atlantis, and so she was the first to tie Lemuria and Atlantis together.
Got it. Okay.
And then that's, you know, where we became full humans, and then, you know, the fifth root race, which I believe we are in now. And then the sixth root race was will happen in America. And then the seventh root race is basically Lemuria has arisen and we are fully enlightened spiritual beings in this new age.
USA, USA, USA. Right? Awesome. Yeah, baby. Sixth root race coming in these United States. So she was a patriot for sure, which is what I love. So this sounds
truly
ties
Russian
together.
Patriot. That's what America needs more of.
Exactly. Exactly. It's like the Americans. You know, whatever. As long as we're on top, baby. But everything's kind of tied together. And it is this kind of interesting little twist here. And she, you know, I believe that she really divorces it from its pseudoscientific past. And she also is responsible for really taking it and instead of being a place, it's an idea, You know, it's a concept, and she admits this, and it's kind of used more freely. So it's not like, hey, it's this continent of the ocean where people came from or jumped to other places from. It's like this is concept of perfection, almost like Eden in the Bible, right? Like it starts to become that, right?
Yeah.
So let's fast forward a little bit because I want to get to everything. I just want to quickly mention Colonel James Churchward. Because every time I read it, I wanted to call him Church Wad, which just feels like a very funny thing to call somebody. Mm-hmm. Not very nice, but very funny. And he, just short stories, he basically shortens Lemuria to Mew, M-U. And that actually becomes important. I don't think I realized that until reading this book. Having seen both those, I thought they were two different places. But that's kind of all he contributes, right, in a sense?
Yeah, yeah. He does like he was the first one to really do the Donnelly job on Lemuria. So try to create this idea that there was an actual physical Lemuria out in the Pacific Ocean. So he even moves it from the Indian Ocean out to the middle of the Pacific Ocean. And so he creates that kind of idea.
Got it. Okay. All right. So we got all that. So now we're at the end of Theosophy. Now this is where things go crazy and I have a hard time following everything. So I want to take it slowly. I'm following your books. I think your book does a great job of laying it out. And you do a great job of talking about the people and the events and how everything's switched around. But we get to Frederick Spencer Oliver, who wrote a very popular book called A Dweller on Two Planets. Now, this is where things get a little strange because the story is basically that he heard voices, but instead of it being something dangerous, it's a guy named Phylos who writes through him and then tells him all of these great fantastical spiritual ideas that he then publishes.
Yeah.
Do I have that right in a
general surface sense? Yeah.
Okay. All right. So tell me, how does he play in this whole story?
Well, he creates the idea of a mystical Mount Shasta. And then later after he dies and the book is published and everything and the book becomes popular, then Mount Shasta gets tied to Lemuria. But he was the first to really create this idea that there's something freaky going on in Mount Shasta.
Okay.
So in his book, A Dweller on Two Planets, it's a book in two parts. The first part tells of a Atlantean nobleman getting in a love triangle with two other Atlantean women and kind of brooding about that. But the interesting thing is he flies around on basically a UFO that's also a submersible. That's a submarine, so it's a UFO / submarine. But when he dies in Atlantis, he gets reborn as a someone who was born outside of Washington, D.C., a guy named Walter Pearson. And then when Walter Pearson moves after the Civil War to California, he meets this Chinese mystic who takes him inside of Mount Shasta. And then once he's inside of Mount Shasta, he meets other ascended masters and he gets astrally projected to Venus and has like a spiritual awakening on Venus. So all this sounds like really cool and fun, but it's a really, really boring book because it's just page after page of this like esoteric Christian philosophies and ideas going on. They're just but that's the general idea. So this Chinese mystic found this character in this book and took him within Mount Shasta. And that idea that Mount Shasta was hollow and that there were also these ascended masters or highly spiritualized beings in and around Mount Shasta kind of took hold. And so so his book wasn't published until 1905. And then it was kind of like a second edition was published in the 1920s. And when that second edition hit, it really hit hard because you had other people kind of like promoting it. And then through that promotion, you have the Rosicrucians running across it. And then they kind of like took that idea of Mount Shasta and the other idea of Lemurians and smashed them together.
Got it. Okay. So this is, you can see why I thought this was confusing. So this is where things get, it gets wild here, but Oliver creates this book. He writes his book, Dweller on Two Planets. Mount Shasta in California is hollow, contains ascended masters, and this is really the first channeled work. It's channeled through this voice in his head named Phylos. So channeling becomes a part of the story. Monchastan Ascended Masters, and I realized that we haven't really described what an Ascended Master is. And if I can do this quickly, I think, I've come across this a lot, so let's get, correct me if I'm wrong here. They are basically human beings who have reached a level of perfection and have ascended to a higher plane and exist there as teachers for us, and certain people can connect with them and gain their knowledge, and they can speak through them, and that through part is the channeling. And so automatic writing is when someone, one of these ascended masters, channels through a person, a real person here, and writes through them. How's that?
That is perfect. That is amazing. I could not have done that any better. That was the perfect example of what an ascended master is. They don't have to be physical. A lot of times they are not physical. They are, you know, more spiritual, like very like a spirit and not actual physical. But sometimes they do appear as physical people.
Right. You know? Yeah, yeah, that's where it kind of gets tricky with there. And so this book was kind of written as automatic writing in that way. And this is interesting because in a lot of periods in history, things happen which redefine what something is. And this is a moment where Mount Shasta, which natives in the area had had stories about Mount Shasta, and but a lot of, you know, a lot of native stories about large geometric objects or large geological formations occur because they've been around a long time and a lot of weird stuff has happened. So it's not necessarily unique to Mount Shasta, but yeah, weird stuff's happened, you know, so there's going to be stories. But this is the first time, once this book comes out, all of a sudden the story, supernatural stories about Mount Shasta kind of skyrocket. And then, so you mentioned the Rosicrucians, and this is also where stuff gets kind of wonky. So let's can we quickly walk through that? Because we got 10 minutes. I want to try to fit this in 10 minutes. Okay. So how can we fit them in? And also, because we got to get to Shaver and Palmer. So let's sit to Rosicrucian leader. What did they add to this? Because lots of supernatural stuff on Mount Shasta seems to be their kind of calling card.
Yeah, so it really... Like, so it was a book by the name of Lemuria, The Lost Continent of the Pacific, creates this idea that the east coast of Lemuria is actually the west coast of America. So when the Lemuria sunk, part of it actually stayed as part of the west coast of America. So
America, Mount baby, we're back in it.
That comes full circle.
Back in it, baby, yeah.
So some Lemurians actually survived that and lived inside Mount Shasta. And so this created a groundswell of people just flocking to Mount Shasta now, like seeking out these Lemurians, seeking out these experiences and having experiences on their own. So it kind of like created its own, it was like its own generator. It was creating itself, creating these ideas of there's being these kind of strange things happening in and around Mount Shasta. And it kind of created this golden age of weirdness around Mount Shasta.
And speaking of golden, I believe Lemurians were tall with golden mullets. And there's nothing more American than a mullet. Maybe it's Canadian. A lot of Canadians have mullets, too. But it's definitely a North American thing.
Well, it depends if they're wearing jean jackets or not.
Right. Yeah, it depends on the era. But mullets are pretty American. So this is that's all that's going on in Mount Shasta. Now let's get to Richard Shaver, who this is where I kind of... You know, up to this point, you can see people using the story for their own advancement, you know, however they want, whatever shysters are grabbing a hold of this and making their money. I don't think a lot of people have the best intentions. Now, Richard Shaver, I think, is a guy who probably has some sort of mental illness. I don't know, but it definitely appears that way. He starts writing some nonsensical stuff that a guy named Ray Palmer turns into a science fiction without adding the fiction part. Yeah. And this creates a whole different situation. So let's walk through them really quickly.
Yeah. So Richard Shaver was a art student who got married. Then he started having basically mental health issues that did get him institutionalized for much of the 1930s. And then as soon as he got out of being institutionalized, he wrote to Ray Palmer, who was the editor of a science fiction pulp magazine called Amazing Stories. Mm-hmm. And he wrote this Lemurian alphabet. He was basically said, this is a primitive alphabet that all words can be like defined. It's very confusing to try to figure out what this alphabet was talking about. But for whatever reason, Palmer printed it, and it got a huge response from the readership of Amazing Stories, who because in the letter, Shaver talked about, you know, hearing these voices, and this is what these voices told him to write. And so people were writing into Palmer saying, you know, I hear these voices as well, too. And so Palmer gets in touch with Shaver, and they start writing stories together, or Shaver sends in some stories. And the first two stories, the first one was I Remember Lemuria, and talks about basically this war going on a, like a pre-Earth of giants and everything else, and spaceship battles and all of that. Mm-hmm. And then the second story is a little bit more Earth-centric, mm-hmm. talks about, I think it's, Memories of Lemuria or something like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it talks about like Shaver himself being harassed by these Darrows, these like evil dwarves who live underground and are just like terrorizing humanity. And so that's really the setup for what came to be known as the Shaver Mysteries. But it just kind of created this idea of not only Lemuria still being underground, but there's like these evil creatures populating underground too.
Got it. Okay. And two quick things here. Shaver wrote a bunch of physics theories, and he presented them to Einstein, who blew them off. This is the second interview I've done. I did an episode on Edgar Allan Poe, who also presented his theories to Einstein with a much different response. But, you know, Richard believed that his brain worked too well, and that bothers me because I sometimes feel exactly the same way. I feel like my brain works too well for this world. They really double down on this hollow earth thing. So mm-hmm. that's kind of what they add. And I want to get us to flying saucers as we close up here. So there are different years in history that I think are extraordinarily important. You know, I think of 1893, you know, mostly for the Columbian Exposition in Chicago. I think of 1947 for lots of different reasons, which are in your book. I think of 1969. 2020 is always a great one to bring up. But in 1947, a couple of interesting things happen. And not the least of which is, and I believe this is the second episode in a row where I've mentioned Kenneth Arnold and the flying saucer. This is where flying saucers enter the zeitgeist of the country. Roswell's a couple weeks later. UFOs are running wild. And many people take that and run with it. But talk to me about how UFOs enter into the Lemurian story after 47.
Yeah. So, Ray Palmer was a huge part of that. Like, UFOs enter into the American consciousness with Kenneth Arnold and his sightings of, these flying saucers over Washington. Later that year, Palmer would create Fate Magazine.
Which you've written for, by the way.
Yes, I have.
Written several articles for Fate Magazine.
I just bought this the other day, but I found a copy of the last Amazing Stories for Mysteries. Yeah.
Look at that. If you're watching on YouTube, check that out. Can I see that again? Let's pop that up on the big screen there. Look at that. Shaver Mysteries, the full version.
So that is Lemuria. And it came out in,
of course,
I can't read it, but 1947 as well. So the very last issue of Amazing Stories that had Shaver in it came out in 47, only because Palmer had shifted his idea or his interest from, you know, mm-hmm. underground worlds into the flying saucers and with his creation of Fate Magazine. So he would go ahead and employ Kenneth Arnold. And so he sent Arnold out to blanking on the UFO case, but that he investigated for Palmer and Fate Magazine in 1947, mm-hmm. the Oak, it was out in Washington somewhere, but it created this like groundswell of just flying saucer mania that kind of took over the United States at the time and created a real groundswell that really hasn't really gone away since then.
Well, it's interesting because, and this is a weird thing where before people were taking science and turning it into spiritual. And this is where the idea of spiritual leaders, ascended masters, astral projection, that spiritual side becomes real. And we say, well, it's actually ETs. These are UFOs. These are highly technologically advanced beings that are giving these messages. And so it does a weird shift in the other direction as this whole thing kind of evolves and goes back and forth. This is really interesting. We got to close with one last thing here. So we got UFOs tied into it. There's one last thing you talk about this. Well, I want to call it a great story in your book, but it might be the most disappointing story in your book as you search for a Lemurian crystal. And crystals have been a part of the New Age movement for a long period of time. And there's a guy named Frank Alper who ties crystals with Lemuria. And I believe this is the last piece we need to come full circle here. So talk to me about how they get tied together and what became of your search.
I will say another one for your YouTube fans.
Viewers at home, look at that.
So it's an actual Lemurian seed crystal. I did get one. I found it at a metaphysical store in Virginia. So I was lucky to find one. And I still
congratulations.
You can't really see it, but it says Lemurian seed crystal. And like I was checking out, they were trying to take it off. I was like, can you please? Easily the price tag on it. It only means something to me because it has that Lemurian seed crystal on it. So he tied this idea of Lemuria being a kind of like an intergalactic highway or Earth being an intergalactic highway. And so on ancient Earth, aliens stopped by Earth, planted these crystal seeds in us for basically fuel for their spaceships, and then just went along their way. And they set up lemurs to be the guardians of these. Crystal fields. But the lemurs got scared off by dinosaurs' masculine energy. And so
I can understand that. If you've seen a T-Rex, you know they're alpha, baby. They're not betas, they're alpha,
especially to a little lemur as well,
right? Understandable.
So yes, and so once everybody and then once we discovered those crystals, then we could start tapping into their energies as well.
Well, this really ties it all together. We're back to lemurs, keeping an eye out. And I believe, you have a great conclusion in your book, which is that Lemuria, where it is now, is it's an idealized place, a concept where spirituality and technology live in harmony and that peace reigns. It's really an idealized world that people are shooting for. And I think that's important, right? I mean, I think using these things as concepts for an ideal are great. To say that it really exists is where you kind of get tricky. So, but I think that's a great conclusion. I mean, do you still stand by that, or was that just for the do you have to have a happy ending for the publisher?
Well, I would say it's it shows that Lemuria has always just been a blank slate for whoever believed in it. So it's just been a place for people to use for their own benefits and their own ideas and to bring it forward too. And so right now it is that idealized place where we as a society are trying to figure out how to work, technology and spirituality, how to live with both of them. And so it's just a manifestation of today's concepts or fears going on right now. So we see an idealized version of that in Lemuria. So who knows what future generations will see in Lemuria, though?
It's true. It is a blank canvas. It's a fair assessment. I think we did a good job. I mean, we left out a lot. I recommend people pick up this book from Pharaoh Publishing. But how can people do that? How can people get in touch with you? And are you interested in hearing other people's theories about Lemuria for a second edition or possibly a sequel?
Oh, yeah. I'm always up for learning more about Lemuria and all the people out there who, you know, still want to find it and locate mm-hmm. it and sing on its shores and all of that. Mm-hmm. So people can find the book anywhere. It's available online everywhere. Bookshop.org, you can find it. Amazon, of course. So you can find it there.
Yeah, and it's, you know, I believe it's through Feral Publishing. Their books are, we focus a lot of their books on here because it's right for the show. It's good stuff. What about you on social media? Do you do that? Do you stay away from it?
I'm on like mostly Instagram and Threads right now. So Justin mm-hmm. loves history. I have a newsletter called Our Belated Past, where I just talk about weird history stuff too. So mm-hmm. I just talked about 18th century sea monsters and investigations into the sea monsters from the 18th century. So it was really fun.
That's great. I wonder if Sigmund the sea monster, did he make an appearance or?
No, it was mostly this one British officer on a British royal ship just started hunting Kraken for some reason. So it was that.
That's great. What about website? I know you have a website.
JustinJMcHenry.com. You can find me there.
That's fantastic. Well, I'm going to put all the links for all the stuff everywhere so people can find you on my website and make it pretty easy. And that's easy to do. It's FascinatingNouns.com. We are on X, at FascinatingNoun, on Facebook, at FascinatingNouns. Justin, this is a great book. You really did a deep dive. It gets confusing, but I think you stick the landing. So I recommend this book, and thank you for doing that. And I may have to pick your brain about other projects I'm working on because Lemuria pops up all over American history. So we'll look for that definitely in the future.
Yeah, thank you so much, Dan, for having me on. I appreciate it.
You got it. I want to thank you, and I want to thank everyone for listening. Have a good night.
Fascinating Nouns is a Glencoe production and is hosted and produced by me, Daniel J. Glenn. The show producer for this episode was Sarah Brandt. The Fascinating Nouns introduction was produced by Daniel J. Glenn and E.A. Barrientos, with music and sound design written and performed by E.A. Barrientos. And I'm guessing after listening to this, you never want to miss another episode. You're going to want to subscribe. We are on all of your favorite podcasting platforms, and we even have links right there on our show website, which is FascinatingNouns.com. You can find all the links right there. And let's say you don't have a favorite podcasting platform. That's no problem. You can listen to every episode right there on the website, which is once again FascinatingNouns.com. And while you're there, don't forget to sign up for our newsletter. It's a great way to learn more about the episodes that you're listening to, find out about upcoming episodes, and to just keep in touch with the community. It's right there on the website. And speaking of community, there's no better way to stay in touch than on social media. And you can find links to our show's Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Pinterest, and YouTube pages right there on the front page of FascinatingNouns.com. And speaking of YouTube, there's a video version of this episode there right now, as well as other past episodes and all future episodes. It's going to be right there, youtube.com/Daniel J. Glenn. It's a great way to see all the guests and check it out live and in person. Feel like you're there in studio. Great way to do it, youtube.com/Daniel J. Glenn. And finally, if you like this show, you're going to like everything that I do. Go to DanielJGlenn.com and check out all of my projects and see what's going on. Once again, thank you for listening.
End of transmission.